Purpose, Joint Interim Task Force on the Apprenticeship in State Contracting. Thank you all for being here this morning. I know we've had some changes in our agenda, and we will work with those as best we can. And again, I appreciate Mr. Sims being willing to take his personal time and join us this morning. This is an informational meeting, and the first thing on our agenda is the review of policies regarding required ratios for apprenticeship programs. And I believe I'll begin by just turning this over to Mr. Sims, if that's appropriate.
Thank you. Just as a broad overview, federal and state law requires that a ratio of journeymen to apprentices be established for all programs and set forth in program standards. The ratios are established by regulation in order to promote safety, training, and education. There's also a side issue that doesn't get discussed, but I think we all know it's true. We want ratios to be equivalent across trades so that no employers can get a competitive advantage on other employers using apprentices by putting more apprentices on the job at a lower wage, because, of course, these wages for apprentices are graduated if they move through the program. So it's important not only that we look at safety training and education with respect to the establishment of the ratios, but also that the ratios be the same or substantially similar across occupation. The way that ratios are set in Oregon changed about 14 years ago. Prior to 1999, we had one standard ratio for all construction programs, which was one apprentice for the first journeyman on the job, and then one apprentice for every three journeymen on the job thereafter. Previously described as one for one, one for three. That was the minimum ratio that anyone could have. Programs could exceed that ratio. For example, they could go one to one, one to five, in order, other words, be five journeymen for the second apprentice, but they couldn't go below one to one, one to three. Based upon input from our program sponsors and the changing needs of the construction industry, the council considered a proposal to convene all of our programs by occupational group, by trade, and have a discussion with them not only about what the appropriate ratio for a specific occupation should be, but also what the minimum standards for classroom instruction should be, and also what the minimum requirements for the individual work processes should be. And so we took this idea and created state guideline committees for each of the major occupations. I believe we have eight state guideline committees. And as an example, if we were to talk about carpenters, for example, we would gather two representatives from every carpentry program in the state, an employer representative and an employee representative, and hold a session of meetings, a series of meetings, where we would talk about classroom-related instruction, where we would talk about the work processes, and we would talk about ratio. And that group would then come up with a preferred ratio for their occupation and recommend that the council adopt it. And generally speaking, when those state guideline committees come up with the ratio, the council will adopt that as a minimum guideline. Again, the individual programs they choose to exceed goes above that, but they have to meet that minimum guideline. So that's basically the process and procedure as to how the ratios are established. And I believe you should have a handout showing the ratios for each of the current major construction occupations. You'll note that by occupation, they're all across the board, because that is the feedback we have gotten from our sponsors. So the policy behind setting ratio is to be as responsive as the council can be to a substantial majority or consensus of the representatives from a given occupation. That's a broad summary about how the council approves ratio. But if there are questions, that might be a better way to address this issue.
Are there any questions?
Katie, maybe since Nelda's here, maybe we could call her up and ask her to
give her some perspective. Would you like to join us?
It would be great if
Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Sims, Nelda is stepping up to join us. She can help answer questions also.
Yeah. Great.
Okay. It's lonely over here. So, I don't know if there are questions, but I think one thing, there's a maximum ratio. I mean, 1-to-1 is the maximum that you can have. So if you have one journey worker and two apprentices, then you're out of compliance, you know. So that keeps everybody from loading up crews with too many apprentices.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
Can I ask, Nelda, I wonder if you could just tell us, you're the assistant co-chair or vice
chair? The vice chair of the
vice
state
chair
apprenticeship.
Could you just tell us something about that council?
Oh, and Co-Chair Deborah, ma'am, would you mind giving us your name for the record?
Nelda Wilson.
And you work for?
I'm the business manager of the operating engineers local for Oregon and Southwest Washington.
Great. Thank you so much.
And she's the vice chair?
Vice chair of the state apprenticeship council. So similar to how JATCs are made up, the council has employer representatives on it and employee representatives. So I'm a trades employee representative because I come out of the operators. So, and then there also has two public members on the council. So that's how that's made up.
Okay. Any questions of this, Mr. Sims or Steve? I hear you. Do you have something to add, or were you just moving around back there?
Well, I couldn't quite hear Nelda's comment, so if someone could just summarize them for me.
Do I need to turn it on?
Why not? Wait, we're going to check and make sure the mic's on, Steve. Just give us a second.
I don't see any lights.
Tap.
No.
Just come up here. Nelda, would you mind just join us up here so this will work?
You can just sit right next to Frank right there.
Okay.
Or yeah, that'll work.
We're moving mics around.
I think that was on. Yeah.
You think that that's
yeah.
on? Okay.
Can you hear her now, Steve?
Hello.
I can't hear you now, but thank you.
Okay. Great. Well, just go ahead and summarize what you said. Thank you.
What I was talking about was they asked how the council was made up. And so it's employer representatives and trades employee representatives plus two public members is what I had mentioned.
Thanks. Any questions for these?
So I think I've got a question for Steve.
Okay.
If I may.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. Steve, it's John Mullis.
Hey, John.
Good morning. So I think if I heard you right earlier, you said that generally you try and get ratios to be the same for crafts, let's just say electricians. But can open shop and union electrician programs have different ratios?
Yes, they can, and what happens in that state guideline process is a recommendation for a minimum ratio comes out of that guideline committee, and that recommendation gets made to the council, and the council generally accepts it. So that is the standard, that is the minimum that no one can go below. But if a local committee decides that they want to have a more restrictive ratio, one requiring more journey workers for each additional apprentice, they can, in fact, do that, and the council will not object to that. The council's goal is simply to set a floor that no program can go below. Off the top of my head, I know there are one or two programs that do have, and I'm looking right now at one of the handouts for the laborers. The laborers have a ratio, the union-affiliated ratios, of one apprentice for the first journey worker and then five additional journey workers for the second apprentice. That is the ratio that was agreed upon as the statewide minimum guideline. However, the open shop ratio, that was the ratio the union laborers adopted. However, the open shop laborers have a ratio of 1-to-1 and then 1-to-3 for the second apprentice. That is the statewide minimum guidelines that the union-affiliated laborers have chosen to exceed. And that's the choice of every individual program should they choose to exceed the minimum ratio.
And can I ask another question?
Please.
So those guidelines are established by the industry, right? By the open shop and union programs sitting down and establishing the ratio for their industries, is that correct?
The industry groups make the recommendation to the council, and I cannot think of a case where the council has not approved and adopted the recommendation of the statewide guideline committee.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
Ms. Wilson, I have a question, being relatively new at this part of it. How often do these recommendations come to you, and how often are they reviewed for change?
Well, we have council meetings every quarter, so four times a year, and that the subcommittee meeting is where you do most of the work ahead of the council.
Not a set schedule for review.
Yes.
They come up as recommendations change coming from...
Right, and councils are reviewed every 2 to 3 years, depending on Bowley's schedule, so the council actually reviews, or Steve's office would review programs, operation, and then bring them to the council if there's any issues or out of compliance.
Okay, so it's fairly responsive.
It is, yes, and you can change, you know, your policies and rules, or you can amend your apprenticeship standard, but all those come through the council, and the state apprenticeship review council reviews all those. And not everything gets approved on the first blush. So,
thank you. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, a couple of questions, if I may, for Ms. Wilson and Mr. Sims. Is, if I understood right what was just said, that if there is a ratio change, that would go to a committee?
The Standards Review Committee.
Standards Review Committee. So mm-hmm. Is that something that is convened when a request comes up, or is that always? Or
four times a year.
Four times a year.
About 2 weeks or so, 2.5 weeks ahead of the council meeting.
Okay, so a program could come to that committee. Mm-hmm. If that committee agrees with the proposal, then that proposal would come to the State Apprenticeship Council.
The subcommittee makes a recommendation to the council.
Okay. And if I may ask one more question. Mm-hmm. In looking at, for example, I'm looking at the handout of the State Apprenticeship Training Council guidelines, and at the bottom of this first page it mentions inside electricians. It's like we always pick on the electricians in these conversations.
Okay.
But one thing I am interested in some background on is on the examples where you can have, you know, 1 to 3 journeymen, maximum number of apprentices, so that would mean you could have 2 journeymen and 2 apprentices in that scenario. Then also in the next one where it's 4 to 6 with a maximum number of apprentices of 4, so you also have a scenario there where you could have 4 journeymen and 4 apprentices. What I'm curious about is, like in this scenario, let's just say somebody has 4 journeymen, 4 apprentices on a job site. A journeyman calls in sick that day, so now you have 3. You have to drop down to 2. So you have to send 2 apprentices home under that scenario, whereas it was okay to be 1-to-1, 4 and 4, but if one person calls in sick, you can't be 1-to-1 and stay 3 and 3 while that person's out sick. You have to drop down to 3-to-2. So I'm curious about the background behind doing it that way, as opposed to 1-to-1's okay at 2-to-2, and it's okay at 4-to-4, but it's not okay at 3-to-3.
And Mr. Sims or Ms. Wilson, whoever wants to field that.
I'm not looking at your example.
Oh, yeah, it's...
for the next trip.
But it actually
Patrick
says...
I'll get you a copy.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I can bring you this one.
I got it.
It's a race.
Looking for a spare one there.
Thank you.
And it actually says it's not okay on this document?
Well, it says if you have 4 to 6 journeymen, you can have 4 apprentices, but if you only have 3, if you have 1 to 3 journeymen, the maximum apprentices is 2. So in what the scenario I was thinking of, if you have that 4 to 6 journeyman number, you would be able to have the 4 apprentices.
Mm-hmm. That's four apprentices and 6 journeymen.
Correct. But okay. It's also 4, it's 4 to 6, so 4 journeymen could also have 4 apprentices.
So, if one person was sick, you'd still have four apprentices and five journeymen.
Well, but you can have four journeymen, and you're able to have four apprentices.
Yeah, but I guess usually the way that stacks up is you have the first one-to-one, and then it's one-to-three thereafter.
Right, but I know just because I'm in that electrical world that on the sheet that the state has where there's a chart and it lists 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, through the journeyman, mm-hmm. and the number of apprentices that you're allowed for each of those. And it lists in that scenario, four journeymen can have four apprentices. And then it drops down to a three journeymen can only have two apprentices.
Mm-hmm.
And two journeymen can have two apprentices. So I was just trying to wrap my mind around where those steps came from. Because in some places it's one-to-one. I get the first one-to-one. That makes complete sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it was that interim one that I wasn't.
Well, the electricians trade have statewide guidelines.
Right.
So that's something that they've agreed to is the ratio. So the council just approved it. And I guess your question is kind of like, well, are you going to be out of compliance that day?
Well, no, I was just wondering if anybody could say what the discussions were that led to those steps in there, where in some cases it's 3-2 and type of a percentage. And
yeah, I wasn't in the meeting when they established the guidelines. I don't know if, Rob, if you were, or you know any of that history?
A little bit. It goes back a long way.
I could speak briefly to that.
Steve
okay.
would be better.
Steve, that would be, do you mind, Mr. Villar?
No, not at all.
Go ahead, Mr. Sims. Thank you.
Approximately 10 years ago, the union-affiliated electricians, their international, went to this essential ratio of two apprentices for three journeymen as their standard ratio in all of their standards nationally. They then came to the state apprenticeship, I should say they, the Oregon IBEW NECA affiliated apprenticeship programs came to the council and said, gee, can we change from the 1-to-1, 1-to-3 to this nationally recognized ratio? The first response from the council was, no, we've never had that type of a ratio. And the second response was, go and sit down with all of the other apprenticeship programs, the open shop programs, the independent programs, all the NECA programs, in a statewide guideline meeting. And they convened and all agreed that that 2-to-3 ratio was appropriate. When we got that consensus back from the group, the council then adopted it. My understanding, and I can't say, this would have to be a question for someone from NECA IBEW, but my understanding as to why they felt that that ratio was appropriate was a matter of flexibility, that sometimes if they had a service job, it would be better for them to be able to dispatch two apprentices and two journeymen. But in order to make sure that there was always an additional journeyman available, if someone called in sick, if someone was absent, they always wanted a third person out there when you had a second journeyman. So that's how they came to the conclusion that two apprentices for three journey workers was the appropriate ratio. The other caveat to that, of course, is that you may never have an inverted ratio of more journeymen than apprentices, but I believe the IBEW's ratio was to make sure that if you were putting multiple apprentices on the job site, that there was a mechanism for keeping an extra journeyman out there to protect having to lay off an apprentice if one of them couldn't make it.
Thank you. So essentially it's what they asked for.
Is that helpful?
Yes, that helped very much.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
It does beg a question from me, though. This is Caddy, Steve. If you did find yourself in that position where you had someone call in sick and you had the apprentices show up, explain to me how that works. Are you out of compliance for a day? What happens?
Well, if you were out of compliance for a day, you would have obviously a compliance issue with us, and if you were on a public works project, you would also have a prevailing wage violation. It is the contractor's obligation to address that situation either by finding another journey worker to work the job that day. I was going to say man the job, but I'm trying to get away from that. But having another journey worker there to work the job that day, or unfortunately, you would have to lay the apprentice off. I believe the council's position, and not only does this comport with prevailing wage law, but we're not going to put the apprentices' safety, training, and education at risk on a random basis just because a journey worker may or may not have been there that day. You either have to get another journey worker out there or you have to lay the apprentice off. And I think that's something that both Mr. Mullis and Ms. Wilson can talk to, having served on the apprenticeship council and being from the trades.
Okay. Thank you.
Two questions, if I may.
Yes, sir.
The first, is this just a typo on this sheet? Again, picking on the electricians.
This is Mr. Mullis.
Apprentices, never to exceed number of apprentices on the job. Should that second one be journey workers?
Right.
You are correct, John.
Okay.
I'm sorry, which line are you on, John?
The far right by the electricians. Apprentices, never to exceed number of apprentices on the job. The second should read apprentices, never to exceed number of journey workers on the job.
Mm-hmm.
On the sheet.
Oh, this one. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong sheet. So just so we can all get it clarified, run it. Which liner?
So
go
it's,
back.
It's the sheet that lists trade and apprentice to journey ratio.
Okay, got it.
Electricians got it. Inside about a third of the way down. Apprentices never to exceed number of journey workers is how it should be.
Okay, we will make
and
that.
John, let me say this. I was trying to access my computer remotely from 1,800 miles away. I'm sure if I could have gotten to all of my boxes, we would have had the correct information.
We're going to give you a pass, Mr. Sims.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
This wasn't my original second question, but now I have to throw it at you.
Please do.
Are you someplace warm and sunny?
No, it's 23 degrees and light snow.
Oh,
okay, I feel better now. Here was my original second question, if I may.
Good morning.
When the electricians industry changed this ratio, was it 1-3 before? So I guess how I'm trying to phrase, or how, the question I'm trying to get answered is, did this new ratio that their industry approved allow for more apprentices per journey level workers?
I didn't hear that last phrase, John.
So when the electrical industry just asked that their ratio be changed and it was approved by the State Apprenticeship Council, does this new ratio allow for more apprentices to journey workers?
Yes. Yes, they went from one apprentice for one journeyman for the first, and then 1-3 for each one thereafter, to this new ratio where conceivably, if you look at the way it counts out, it's almost like one apprentice for each 1.5 journey workers across the board. I guess that's the way to look at it mathematically.
Okay, that helps. Thank you.
Ms. Wilson.
Yes, I just had a comment. With the apprenticeship for electricians, there, because of the state licensing, those apprentices have to have supervised hours. So even for a day, if you ended up paying an apprentice journeyman rate and, you know, or brought in another journeyman, you still have to have supervised hours for that apprentice to be able to complete their program and sit for the electrical test. So there's two reasons to have a licensed journeyman there, not just the apprenticeship.
Mr. Gurdy.
Not really a question, but a comment, as realizing this is fact-finding and informational sorts of things, but this maybe is a good example, wearing my contractor's hat and for the general contractors, just making sure as we go forward and we look at an apprenticeship utilization standard and those sorts of things, the complexity upon a general, if somehow it drills down into a penalty-driven basis of how, when you go beyond the trade and their responsibilities and pile onto a general contractor to somehow track and monitor and be responsible for all these sorts of things, it gets pretty complex. And it's just a comment that as you hear some of these sorts of things and thinking about a given employee and we're trying to maximize apprenticeships on a project and a given journeyman does not show up for a particular trade and all of those different sorts of things. So
thank you.
Just toss that out.
Anyone else have questions or comments while we have Mr. Sims on the line? Yes, Ms. Wilson.
Oh, I was just going to comment on what you said, that you have a JATC that monitors how many apprentices go to what each contractor. So in general, they're going to be there and help you stay in ratio. And then I know our dispatchers do. They know where the apprentices are and what jobs. And so we try to keep contractors from getting out of ratio. Just by our process.
Is that for open shop as well as subcontractors for the JATC and the representation?
The JATC is the same whether it's open shop or union.
So how does that, because we do lots of general contracting, and of course we don't have the apprenticeship standard requirements in this state other than outside of ODOT, but how would that work for me if I'm doing a school project? We're in the thick of it. I've got everything from excavation going on outside and site work all the way to interior finishes and the HVAC subs working and the electrical doing finishes. And, you know, I've got 15 trades going on.
Well, it's per trade. So each trade's going to have a standard, right?
I understand that. I'm saying on our end for being able to monitor. Again, I can get it. I can put it in the contract and say each subcontractor is responsible to meet those given guidelines.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And hey, we're about schedule and about, you know, getting everything done and we're self-performing. Hey, I've got my own apprenticeship standards.
Right.
How, other than the subcontractors coming to us and assuring us that given piece, how am I tracking that?
That's more of a contracting question than a council question.
That's right. That was the point I was making.
Yeah. Okay.
Is that an appropriate question for Mr. Sims? I'm not sure. Mr. Sims, were you able to hear Mr. Girding's question?
Only pieces of it, if you could summarize it, please.
Yeah, I guess I was not as much making a question as I was just for laying maybe some groundwork for further discussions of the complexity of, as a general contractor, it's one thing to contractually require our subs. We do it all the time with prevailing wage. And
pull the mic a little closer to make sure Mr. Sims is
okay. More just about the reality of how do we track and monitor the percentages and the compliance of all of that on a given project when we have a large number of subcontractors on the site performing the work, and the given issues we're talking about as we have these ratios, and when things get down tight and a particular journeyman doesn't show up and therefore for that given day potentially a subcontractor falls out of compliance. Just that it does get complex and messy, and while we work through those given things on prevailing wage with the wage certs, all those varying sorts of things, it is since we don't do this now, to put that onto the general contractor somehow to be able to track and monitor that on a daily basis. On given trade specifics and everything else, not to go on, but I think that's one of the basis why ODOT was talking about. Ultimately, they tried some of the challenges on that to where, and again, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but the trade specific and all those different sorts of things can just become exceedingly complex. So.
Mr. Sims?
And I would agree. I think that the general has tons of rules, regulations, and details they need to track. This is another one of them. I don't know if Ms. Mathieu from the City of Portland is there today. They, I believe, review those monthly, but the bottom line is someone does have to report that information. And no doubt about it, it is an additional piece of paperwork or accounting work for the general and for those subs.
One last comment on that. An acknowledgement that doesn't happen for free. So.
Yes, sir.
Yes, it doesn't happen for free. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm intrigued to hear.
Can we get a mic so Mr. Sims can?
I'd love to have
we can push.
And a gavel. It'll settle through, Mike.
You need two of them?
Yeah, they're stereo. Well, it's
whoa.
Are you okay?
I'm good.
All right. Bull in a china closet here. It's intriguing to hear this discussion. I mean, and I guess what we're talking about is the level of detail on reporting that can be required, and in fact, I guess, is in certain situations that really don't seem to take into account the fact that sometimes life happens. You know, people aren't able to make it to a job on a given day. Things happen in their personal life or whatever. But if, in fact, the contractor, whether it's the sub or the general, is in danger of being found non-compliance, then it's hard for me to see how that scenario, if in fact we're interpreting the law, that's to the gnat's eyebrow, if you will, on compliance by almost an hour-by-hour and day-by-day basis, is it certainly isn't good for the general because it creates issues for you. Can't be good for the apprentice that has to be laid off and sent home because they're going to miss an entire day of learning their trade, if they will. So it just seems to me, as we talk about overall and averages and so forth, rather than looking at the specific trade on a specific hour-by-hour basis, are you in compliance, is a really hard thing on everybody, and it's hard to see how it really is good for anybody, in my perspective. But I don't dwell in that world in my what I do, but it's just hard for me to see what some of you all have to deal with, and I can understand the frustration that ensues. But again, it certainly doesn't speed up the completion of that project either if you have one person that isn't able to show up for whatever reason and then we have to lay off other people because they can't be there. That doesn't bring the project to complete. It isn't good for anybody. So I'd just like to get Bowley's, I guess, perspective on that. And if, is that problematic with you all and just trying to keep track of who's on first, because that's a major issue.
Mr. Sims? I have a comment.
And I think that what I will do is liken it to our prevailing wage unit, for example. They look at everything on an hour-by-hour basis, and we do the same thing with respect to apprenticeship. So it might be overstating the case to say that that the apprentice has to be sent home for the whole day and the whole day pay, but when you're keeping track of wages, if that journeyman is there for half a day, for 2, 3, 4 hours, they can have that apprentice. I mean, basically, we're tracking work hours in general for prevailing wage purposes. For apprenticeship purposes, we're tracking supervised hours. That's not to say that it's not a lot of work, but it is a process that's established and is in place. But it's a part of the bureaucracy when we have laws that apply to prevailing wage and to the supervision of apprentices. If there were any way to supervise it or simplify it, I'd certainly be open to it, and I think the council would be open to it.
I'd like to just ask a question to help educate myself, and it could be either Mr. Sims or Mr. Gerding or whoever chooses to answer, but when you have a general contractor overseeing a project and you have multiple subs and the subs are working with the ratios of apprenticeships to journeymen, the documentation that's tracking this is done by the subcontractor, correct? And that what level of oversight is required of the general contractor in certifying that these are accurate? Because this is something I'm just not familiar with.
Tom, would you like?
Sure, I can talk to that end. What we typically do is we then capture those we call them certified payrolls, and they come into our home office, submitted by the subcontractor.
Daily, weekly.
I've got to think of our operation. I'm a little bit removed from the detail of it, but I believe they come in at monthly.
Monthly. Okay.
You know, or we consolidate them monthly. We do compare them, and it actually they may come in weekly. And compare and consolidate them monthly, I believe. But and what we do is we go back to our daily reports. We require our superintendents to monitor which subcontractors were on the project that day, how many employees they had that day. We compare that to the certified payrolls to make sure that it accurately reflects. If there is a differential, we'll go to generally push it to our superintendent. And then to the sub trades foreman and work out whatever differences on that. So we consolidate those certified payrolls And now it gets a little foggy for me whether whether we actually send those in or whether we're to retain those in case they need to get audited or exactly how that process works. And I'll go to either of you to answer on that.
I was going to say that the city of Portland, I mean, we collect the certified payrolls and those get reviewed by our project managers. But we also collect separate monthly reports, which we review for compliance with our apprenticeship requirements that we have in at the City of Portland. And those are reviewed by compliance specialists in our office. So we're looking at things like whether or not the contractors are within ratio when they're working on the project. And then we report actually back to the general contractor to let them know how everybody's doing towards meeting the requirements and if people are out of ratio and what are you doing to remedy that. And so we're constantly kind of communicating back and forth to the general contractors on our projects to make sure that people are in compliance.
Question is,
sure.
Does that work pretty well?
It has, yeah.
Okay.
I think as long as people are really good about communicating and getting information to our office if we request it, it's been pretty successful, I would say.
And is that goal-driven? Is it mandated? Is it?
It is a requirement. The City of Portland has a 20% apprenticeship requirement on its projects at a certain dollar threshold.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Robbins.
Yeah, Ron Robbins with the Carpenters. I guess part of this speaks to training agent status, I guess, in my mind, is that training agent status, and Steve, you can jump in anytime I fumble this, but it's a commitment by the employer to take an active role in the training process, and thereby the state recognizes that benefit to the individual and to the industry overall and gives economic benefit through a waiver of journey wages for those training hours. So also on the as far as tracking and compliance, as far as I know, all apprenticeship programs require that the individual apprentice log his hours and remit those hours to the training program, and so there's that additional oversight beyond the certified payrolls. Is that correct, Mr. Sims?
You're 100% correct, Rob. Thank you.
Layer of reporting is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, the individual.
That's, I guess that's what I meant by the JATCs monitor that, the training coordinator for that group, because apprentices are required to turn in their timesheets basically of what they did and what work processes they did, so the JATC or the apprenticeship coordinator can monitor their training and make sure they get all the training in the right buckets, I guess you could say. So all the hours apply to their education.
Mr. Green, so then if there was a discrepancy, you could go back to that record to verify. How does that connection work if there's an issue?
I guess we really haven't had any of those. Speaking as, you know, with my other hat on. Yeah. In a perfect world, I mean, we don't have very many problems with too many apprentices on a job. It's really too few. I mean, that's the norm, you know. And like I said, I've been an officer and on our JATC for 18 years. So, you know, it's more of a battle to get too many, to get enough apprentices, not too many. And there's those cushions, I think, that Steve talked about. We have the same thing built into our standard. So you've got leeway, you know, if you're even manned up to the standard just because one or two people are missing. You're not going to be out of compliance. So it's not totally difficult. And also with Kathleen's comments, I've served on the South Waterfront Oversight Committee for the last 10 years as chair of that. And we review, so the buildings that go down have been built up in the central district at South Waterfront. There's an oversight committee. And those reports from the general contractor and all their subs are gathered. They're put into a monthly report. Sometimes we meet monthly. Sometimes it's every month. And then we'll review those, too, to see, because what we're trying to do on that project is to maximize apprenticeship and also to maximize diversity. So we're trying to say, okay, you know, next hire, could you hire a female because you don't have enough women on your crew or something like that to meet those goals. And they're all soft goals, and it's all just conversation. You know, there's no stick with this, with that program, but it's really been successful, and we've had, you know, our employers and the generals have really been great. They've been cooperative. You know, we've been done really well to meet the goals, apprenticeship and the diversity goals, and I think everybody cooperates and works really well. And, you know, there's a standard report that they turn in to the committee. That's what Kathleen was referencing.
Thanks. I have a couple of further questions. First, you know, that issue of what happens to an apprenticeship if an apprentice if a journeyman doesn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, are there safety issues that would prohibit that person from continuing to work? I mean, is that a factor as well? I don't know. That, and my second question is, what exactly happens if a contractor is deemed to be out of compliance with the trade ratio? I mean, what, you know, what's happening today in terms of a stick?
Well, the yes, like Ron said, the training, you know, you're training agents, so the contractor has to live up to their training agent status, and if a contractor were to really abuse that, then that would be brought before the state council. And I can think of one in, this is my sixth year on the council, I think we barred one training agent, and they were horribly out of compliance and were not even, I'm not so sure they even understood the rules that they agreed to. There was a bit of a language problem, I think.
But if I can follow up, but in the practical sort of day-to-day implementation of this, mm-hmm. is there a certain amount of wiggle room?
Well, I think the crew makeup, and especially like the electricians, they're going to have leads, they're going to have foremen. I mean, if that journeyman working with that apprentice isn't there that day, I don't know why an apprentice couldn't be supervised by one of those leads or one of those foremen. And also the electricians most recently have had a I believe it's their 95% apprentices can work unsupervised for so many hours. So if you had a high-level apprentice, then that apprentice technically wouldn't need supervision for it, you know, that day, or he would check in with a foreman or a lead on the job.
I thought Mr. Mullis, Mr. Redmond, and Mr. Malala got you in the queue.
So part of this most recent discussion is kind of where I was going, and I'm not, when I speak, I'm not pushing back against what Mr. Gerdinger, Representative Johnson, you know, spoke to earlier and the complexities of it. But I think we all need to recognize that the original rules for having these ratios is for safety and for proper training.
That's right.
I mean, that's what they're all about. And unfortunately, I think one of Rod had an apprentice that was killed on the job, I think, a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, that's becoming less and less over time in the construction industry. But construction is it still a dangerous industry. It's certainly much safer than it is, you know, 35 years ago when I started as an apprentice. But it's safety, and it's all about proper training. You safety is number one, and you have to have proper training and proper ratios so that, and as Delta spoke to earlier, your work processes. I'm a bricklayer. I laid brick, I laid stone, I laid block, I worked on a grout crew, I ran a saw. You have to do all different kinds of things in order to become a well-rounded journey level worker. And you have to have proper journeyman supervision to make journey level supervision to make sure that you turn out a well-rounded craftsperson.
Thank you. In addition to being an electrical contractor, I also am a committee member for the Area 2 Inside Electrical JATC. And I agree absolutely with what Mr. Mullis and Ms. Wilson are saying, that it is about the training. It is about providing a safe environment for the person to work in. It's to everybody's best interest that they go home in the same condition at the end of that day as they came to work in. We need them to come back the next day And it is about the education. It's in everybody's best interest when that person turns out as a journeyman and they're hired as such, they bring with them the skills that that title implies. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody's on the same page there. I feel a little bit bad for my initial question after this discussion. The point I was trying to make is, like, on our JATC, we take it very seriously, the whole racial question. And if we find out that, or hear of, even rumor, that somebody was out of ratio, you know, for us, that's a very serious thing. And we bring that training agent before our JATC, and the consequence of that type of action can be to revoke their training agent status, and they can no longer have any apprentices. So it's taken very seriously. My initial question, what I was just trying to bring up, is one-to-one, absolutely, the idea of putting an apprentice working someplace without direct supervision, which is what's required, direct supervision of that apprentice, you know, that's unthinkable. My initial question was, in some trades, such as ours, for us, on some of the work that goes on, it's a very common crew size to have that four-person crew or that eight-person crew. So not to get away from a one-to-one, but just in that one particular scenario that we do run into, just because the crew of electricians on a lot of work going on is in that size range, that if we have a journeyman, one of four journeymen call in sick, we have to send home two apprentices. So it's not a question of one-to-one or an apprentice working unsupervised. It was just meant to be, on my part, an example of maybe some things within how it works that wouldn't be a significant change, but could help somebody in that situation maintain apprentice hours on the job. That's good for the apprentice. It's good for the whole economic picture of construction, as opposed to somebody who maybe doesn't have as much resources to monitor. You know, some people have the ability to have somebody in their organization. Their job is just scheduling people. So they maintain that schedule. Who's with who? Who's worked with who? Who's going to what job site? You can get a smaller outfit. They don't have that ability. And there's the potential, guy calls in sick, somebody doesn't think about the fact. There's one journeyman with every apprentice still, but somebody doesn't recognize, oh, wait, that's a problem. At this particular crew size, that's not allowed. And so that's all I meant to bring up. My initial question is not that we should ever get away from that fundamental providing the safe environment, good training, turnout, good journeyman, but just to make it a little bit easier in some cases, somebody can be in trouble and out of compliance, but not in a way that affects the safety and the training and the education of that apprentice. It's almost like because we can't divide people 1.5 to 1, we get a couple places in there where you still have 1 to 1, but the guy called in sick, so two people go home.
So, Mr. Redmond, the way I understand this, and again, forgive me if I'm wrong, the way I understand your concern, is this something that Ms. Wilson could be brought to the Apprenticeship Training Council for consideration if he has a particular issue with that particular ratio? Is that the vehicle for which that discussion would occur?
Well, they have a statewide guideline standard, so I think they'd have to convene that committee first and then get agreement within that committee and then bring
But that would be an
council.
Appropriate place for
Absolutely.
That conversation to occur.
Yeah, and if it's been 10 years since it's been reviewed or since you've had one of those committees, maybe it's time to have one now.
Yeah.
Sounds like it may be. Okay.
Thank you. I was just trying to kind of
Sure.
clarify a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah. But I brought it up. It's not a huge issue by itself, but just a little example.
Maybe an opportunity for a conversation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Belisle.
That was going to be my comment, was that there is an avenue for specific issues regarding ratio to be addressed. It's up to each trade, and I can think of a lot of scenarios where one-to-one might be a good idea. I can think of a lot of scenarios where it's not a good idea. You know, just an everyday example, if you go into the grocery store and there's 10 check stands, if every checker was training somebody, you'd have a long day.
You know? As would me, the consumer.
Everybody understands that. And so although the ratio may be three journeymen to two apprentices, there's not huge instances where we meet that maximum ratio because it's just not practical.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're getting a little caught up in the numbers, and it's really already been addressed by each individual trade based on the tasks they do. Some things we do one-to-one very easily. Many things we don't because it just doesn't make sense. And that needs to be addressed really by each trade. But that status has already been created, and we have something to work from already.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions or comments while we still have Mr. Sims on the line? I want to be sensitive to his time. We've had him on the line here for an hour and sitting 1,800 miles away on a phone when you can't see anybody's faces and what's happening in the room and you don't have access to your computer is kind of trying, so I want to be sensitive to your time.
I'm not a problem.
So should we have Gerda speak to the concerns?
Sure. Mr. Gerding, actually, I'll give Senator Dembrough credit for bringing this up, but would you like to take an opportunity to speak to AGC's concerns while we have Mr. Sims on the line? Anything specific you would like to bring up to him?
You know, are you talking about apprenticeship at large?
Yeah.
I guess I'll make a general comment, and that is that our friends on the trade side will, I think, completely acknowledge as well. Nobody is more aware of the challenge of our depleting workforce than those of us who make a living by employing those individuals to do the work. And so we absolutely are all in with addressing that issue, which apprenticeship is the very core of.
And moving that mic down.
So just to be very clear, we are all for apprenticeship. It is critical and how we grow the workforce, all of those given pieces. I think our concern is ultimately when it comes to an issue of a mandated requirement, how do we go about that? And when we're putting something in place that by and large, I mean, aside from ODOT, does not exist statewide. You know, certainly the metro areas with the city of Portland and different ones have programs in place. We look at it on a statewide basis. Again, our membership, sound like a broken record for those that have heard it, but you know, we're just extremely diverse. Large, small, union, open shop, general, specialty, across the board. And so from that basis, and I would also I think stick my neck out and say if we had a given percentage across the board on all projects start next year, there are not enough apprentices to achieve that goal. And I mean, I think the trades would acknowledge that too. So putting something in front of us to encourage us to gain apprenticeship, we really, I mean, you know, in general as an industry, you know, there's always some bad actors, but in general as an industry, you know, we acknowledge that. Again, how do we go about that? How do we get a program in place? The things that are important to us is we go about it slow.
Mm-hmm.
We think it through so that we get it right. You know, if we try to go too fast and we get it wrong, we just mess up a huge base of our industry, and a lot of other different sorts of things on that. You know, we want to make sure that we're not where in an area that has very active apprenticeship and education on that side, giving that sector geographically of the state an advantage over other areas of the state that aren't necessarily up to speed with it as well. I mean, those are all the sorts of things that are important to AGC, is ultimately being realistic in what we ultimately set as a goal, the speed within implementation, all of those varying sorts of things.
You bring to mind our Career Technical Education Revitalization Grant. Mm-hmm. When we talk about trying to fill the pipeline and the efforts that the state's put forward to try and bring those programs back into our high schools, and my hope is we can have some success with those, but it is going to take some time. These yes. things don't happen overnight. It's brand new. We're expanding it from, I believe, 20 to 140 high schools that are just coming online.
Yep.
142, and hopefully we can begin to address some of that issue with that program. But your point is well taken.
We are, and of course we were highly behind that and thrilled to see that in place. I guess one last point, you know, of course we have mm-hmm. also within AGC we have the heavy highway group that a large component of their work is associated with ODOT, and then we have the vertical builders such as myself, and working hip in hip with those contractors, and I guess all of the lessons learned from ODOT. If there's a piece I could point to, I would say, you know, let's not miss the fact and the lessons learned and the countless dollars that have gone into that program for them to get to the success point they are, and try to reinvent the wheel separate from that. I think that's a very important piece as well, and of course looking to our neighbors to the north.
Good. Thank you. Mr. Wall.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a point about there's another aspect that, you know, we can increase the utilization, and we have work and job sites that handle it, but these are also students who come in at night on a Monday night or two nights a week, and so we have facilities, and I can speak for the local 290 facility, we're at capacity right now. We have no parking. So what we're looking at is, you know, the possibility of having to build a new training center. And then if you build the new training center, the cost of that, and then what if work goes down? So there's some business decisions in to try to handle that as well. Also, if I was in the rural area, you increase it. Do they have the instructors, the qualified instructors out in those areas to teach? Because even though we tried online training and remote training, we have 11 training centers throughout the state of Oregon. We actually sometimes have to have the people come to Portland to do some of the work. So it does add a burden to JDC's trust, increasing the utilization and not being able to have the ability to educate the people.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Robbins.
Just on the Carpenters, we're 6,000 members roughly in the state, and we have any given day we have around 600 apprentices, and they're scattered from rural areas from one end of the state to the other, out to the coast, and in Southwest Washington too. We represent part of that. I sat on for many years the EIS, Interior Systems, JETC, and one of the duties there was before our monthly meeting we would have interviews for applicants, and this goes on even though I'm now working on the state committee, but one of the frustrations for me in that role was it's a great opportunity because you get to see these young kids, many of them, maybe they're coming out of school, maybe they've been out of school and knocked around at low-paying jobs or jobs that just didn't have a future or benefits or a family wage, and then they wind up somehow on our doorstep there and applying for an apprenticeship program. And one of the frustrations for me personally was to sit and talk to some of these young people, and they're bright, they're strong, I mean they're physically constructed for the trades, they're eager, I mean they just really want that opportunity, but we couldn't take everybody. We can't take everybody. Our so many of those kids that I would just love to get on a job site and see what they could do With a little instruction, you just know they could be great carpenters and have a bright future. But I can only take those spots that I have for folks now. I mean, we run about 10% apprenticeship numbers right now. And we have most of our labor agreements, matter of fact, I think all of them require 20% utilization. But on a small job, on a small crew, it's difficult to get, always meet that maximum utilization. So we're always lagging, and it's not because folks aren't available. I mean, literally, during the downturn, our eligibles list that we draw off or put on the out-of-work list and send out as new apprentices, folks languished on there so long that we lost them all. They all had to reapply and had to rebuild that through the downturn. That was really difficult for us, and I'm sure for people who are waiting and hoping that they'll go to work in the trades and, you know, have a future in the industry, it must be extremely frustrating. So I think anything that helps address, there's people, young people and old. You know, many of our apprentices, I think the average age now is 25 years old. So we're talking about folks maybe that have been working in the industry for many years and now are coming back saying, you know, I need some formal education mm-hmm. to take my career to the next step. It's those folks too. I think there's obviously the need, and there's certainly the pool of applicants for the Carpenters Program. We can't handle them all. And just one last point on the those JATCs in the rural areas. We've been consolidating our outlying JATCs, and part of the issue there is just, you know, lack of contractors, signed training agents in those areas. And when there's the lack of participation, you know, the program constricts. We have to be economic and, you know, good stewards of the money, just like any other business. And I think if you had more utilization in those areas, you would have more apprentices in the outlying areas. Mm-hmm. You know, the sad thing is those folks now, you know, without more supportive apprenticeship, have to travel those many miles into the city. And so our program, they go to school four times a year. They take a week off from work and they go to the training center. Now, if you're from very far away, our program will put you up and we feed you while you're there for that week, but you don't get paid. You're going to school. And that can be a real hardship for some of these people, especially if you're traveling in from the coast or that. So it's consideration.
Thank you. Shall we let Mr. Sims off the hook now? Any other questions for Steve?
Not perfect.
Steve, we're going to move on. Oh, please.
I want to clarify the Bureau's position on this whole issue and also just briefly touch two other issues that were raised in the contractors' issue. And first of all, as Tom said, the number one issue here is we've got to build up the pipeline. Kids aren't getting out of school with the skills to begin to enter an apprenticeship program, and that's why CTE and any related career and technical program is important. The other position on behalf of the Bureau is we're here to do what the legislature says as interpreted by the council. So we don't have a position on whether or not mandatory apprenticeship utilization or optional apprenticeship utilization. We want to see more apprentices, but that's not our job to determine how that happens. But we will follow whatever the decision of this task force and the legislature is. With respect to the two other issues that were raised in the contractor's letter, the first is with respect to the difficulty in getting programs approved. I think that may be a hangover from a situation that maybe existed 15, 20 years ago when we did have a needs test for approving new programs. And so frequently new programs were not approved because existing programs would say, we can meet your need to train. We eliminated that needs test 8 or 9 years ago. Now we go strictly on whether or not a program sponsor can submit a proposal that shows that they can fulfill all the obligations of a registered apprenticeship program? Do they have related instruction in place that has been approved either by a state educational institution or an international trade association? Do they have the system for administering the program? Can they abide by the journeyman ratio, apprentice journey? We basically have a checklist, and if programs meet that checklist, they get approved. In the last 7 years, both Mr. Lowis and Ms. Wilson know that much to their consternation, new programs were approved in their occupation because at the time of their application, they demonstrated that they could do what needed to be done. Now, when a program is approved that does not meet those requirements, we will deny them. And in the few times in the last few years that we've denied a program, well, the council hasn't had to take a vote to deny the program. Once we give the sponsor documentation that you don't have a competency testing system, you don't have adequate support and administrative infrastructure to run a program, those programs say, you're right, and they withdraw. So I don't think, I think by and large, any program is approved within 90 days of submission to us that meets the council's quarterly meeting schedule. I don't think that's a problem anymore, but if people still believe that's the case, I'd be happy to talk with them. And finally, the question that Ron briefly discussed, there was an issue raised in the contractor's letter about training in the more rural portions of the state. And years ago, there were small programs in each of the trades in every single corner of the state. Mm-hmm. The industry, as Ron says, has consolidated. Other than in the licensed trades, most of the training centers are in the valley, somewhere between Portland and Medford. And those apprentices, for the most part, have to travel into Portland for their related instruction. Those Portland programs, when they look for new apprenticeship applicants, they post their applications, their request for applications, in those rural areas. They notify those apprentices individuals if they're selected. They will have to come into Portland. Now, in those rural areas, in the electrical and plumbing trades, because by statute, they're required to have an apprenticeship program. Well, you know what? There are both open shop and union-affiliated programs in every single corner of this state that it's required that they do apprenticeship. So the reason why there are not more standalone programs outside of the valley is that the industry has changed, and it's more cost-efficient for them to bring into their training centers in the valley. Whenever there is sufficient interest in those rural areas to start a program, and in the building and construction trade, that means you need to get a group of contractors together. If they can meet those obligations set out in our statutes and administrative rules for program approval, we will approve their program. But I think it's just a natural consolidation within the industry to bring those training resources to a single, or in the case of a couple of the trades, like the electricians and the plumbers, multiple training centers primarily located in a heavily populated area. So I hope that at least it addresses some of the other concerns that were raised in the contractor's area, but I'd be happy to talk to anybody about those more at a later date.
Mr. Mullins.
Can I ask you one more question before you go, Steve?
Yes, sir.
And just for clarification, I think there's a JTC for every craft in the union side of the trades. I think in the open shop, there's the overwhelming majority have programs as well, correct? I mean, I think there's only a handful of trades where there isn't programs on both sides of the fence in the state. Is that correct?
The only one major building trades, well, of the 15 major building trades, the only ones where there are not open shop programs would be iron worker and plasterer. Otherwise, there is an open shop program and a union program in the state in every major occupation.
Any more comments or questions? Yes.
As we talk about trying to reach rural areas, I'm wondering what...
This is Representative Johnson.
As we try to reach out to all sectors of Oregon, I'm wondering currently what kind of role or purpose or function do the community colleges have in providing any of these programs, or could you see an avenue where the community colleges could pick up more of the slack where there aren't standalone programs that are currently in operation?
When there is adequate interest in the region among the contractors, and choosing my words very carefully here. If there's adequate industry interest, the community college will pick up an apprenticeship program if it generates FTE for them.
Okay, that's all.
And I would comment how Mr. Sims and I met in a former life of mine. I worked for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission for many, many years, and I had a great deal of interaction with community colleges, the Oregon University System, private, all the higher ed systems. And Mr. Sims was kind enough to come help me train volunteers and high school staff statewide on how students access apprenticeship programs. And at that time, in my community, we had a fairly significant presence on our community college campus with apprenticeship capability. That has gone away. So the landscape's changed. For some reason, it may have to do with the economics of what we've been experiencing for the last 5 or 10 years, but the landscape changed a bit. And I guess that my question would be, we did have that at one time. Why did it go away? And to Representative Johnson's question, is there a chance that those connections can be remade, particularly in the rural communities where getting to a training center is difficult for our young people? And I know, Senator Dembro, you may have some more current information about that also.
Yeah, I'm not sure I have more current information, but I know that there were some problems in the past with some of the community college programs sort of gaming the system. I have a memory of that, especially out in the rural areas. There was I think Clatsop on the coast was contracting with, I don't remember what, but it was very messy, and CCWD had to clamp down, and I think there was a constriction then in some of those programs, but and maybe there was too much constriction. I don't know.
It's an interesting topic of conversation, particularly for us who are a little more isolated.
Yeah, one more follow-up, though, but I do think that there's, within the education realm, there are policy changes now as we talk about specifically 40-40-20, because as we talk about apprenticeship programs and CTE certifications, we're really talking about that middle 40 and 40-40-20. And as we talk about funding formula, revamping and changing things and so forth, and creating incentives for degree completion, there's a realm here for the public education world to perhaps provide some tracks to expand these sort of offerings in parts of Oregon through the community college system that exists. So we've got a dynamic in place now that hasn't been in place before. So this could be helpful to what we're looking for.
And then the question for me then would become, we're investing in the Career Technical Ed Revitalization Program in a fairly significant way. Do those kids, as they prepare with more hours, more academics, and more readiness to walk into an apprenticeship program right out of high school, are they better served to go on to community college or go straight into an apprenticeship program? Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. But the goal is to prepare them to go straight into the apprenticeship program. If there's some remediation that needs to be done, maybe the community college is the place to do it. So this is a great topic of conversation. Mr. Robbins.
The Carpenters program is, and I think most of the union programs are all college accredited or associated with community college in one way or another. I know our program, you do get college credits for the classes. So.
Yes, sir.
A comment along that lines, and this goes off just a small little rabbit trail, but I think very pertinent, is the 40-40-20. I'm down in Corvallis, and we had a community meeting, several hundred attended the other morning, and that was brought up, and it was brought up from the educational standpoint, and it was very clearly depicted, I think, excluding the trades as part of that 40%. And I made a comment to that end saying, I think that it's an accepted piece that 40% is apprenticeships. And it was said, I'm not sure that, and it all goes to the imaging basis, yeah, that somehow apprenticeship is a substandard education. And so if you all could use your clout to push and get it promoted that 40% is apprenticeship, and apprenticeship is not once again, something that is, when you failed at all else, you know, why don't you come along into the trades, and it's some substandard thing. You know, we're working hard in our industry to elevate that element in our image campaign of construction, and it doesn't help when we're not getting that followed through also at that level.
Spring, you just hit on something that I'm very, very sensitive about, because I spent 8 years training high school staff and volunteers working with high school students about what options students have coming out of high school, and we have a perception problem.
Yep,
I spent a lot of time working with staff and volunteers, making sure that students who want to go into the trades or taking math can write at a level that it's where they understand and can speak the written word well, that they're taking enough math to be useful for all of you who are trying to train people in the trades. And it is a really hard sell. I'm going to be perfectly honest. And again, Mr. Sims was kind enough to come and help me in that endeavor. And it's something that we have a perception problem with. And I don't have a great answer for how we get past that, but collectively we all need to get past that, because these are great, well-paying family jobs that we need to be promoting that are part of how we're going to get to the 40-40-20. And if you have ideas, I'm happy to help you.
Let me just say this, and then I will sign off, that we do work with the State Workforce Board and the Governor's Labor Liaison, and apprenticeship is on a statewide level included in the middle 40. That word may not have gotten out yet to the people in some of the local LIBs and the rural regions, but it is in the middle 40. I think this whole issue of how we support apprenticeship is worthy of a separate discussion, because most of our programs are affiliated with the community colleges, but they're on what's called cost recovery. They don't get a single dollar of state support that they don't pay the services for. So apprenticeship is fully supported by the private industry. There is no public education subsidy, even though they go to these schools. So essentially, we're pushing apprenticeship as a state strategy, but other than supporting our office, there's no money in. So it's a big issue. If you put that money in to career and technical instruction at the community college level, reach out to industry, you can then reach down to the high schools. That needs to be addressed, but it just might be a little bit too broad for this discussion. But with that, I will say no more. I will be in attendance at the next meeting, and thank you for indulging me by telephone.
Thank you, Steve. Take
thank
good
you
care.
Thank you, Steve.
Senator Dembrough.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, Tom, if you would like to see us use our best offices to change that perception, your wish is my command. We are actually there. So let me say, I agree with Steve that apprentices are supposed to be counted in the middle 40, but there's variety in how that's being really interpreted and talked about. And so there will be legislation introduced in February to make it very clear that apprenticeship programs are to be counted in the middle 40.
Fantastic.
And I think there's a little bit of resistance from the governor's office on that, because they're saying, well, we don't need this legislation. That's already how it is. But, you know, I think everyone around this table knows, we've heard people say that it's not. So let's do it. We'll have hearings around it. It'll give us another opportunity to get the word out about how important apprenticeship is as an element in our post-secondary sector. And, we can put this myth to rest.
Mr. Mullis.
Well, Senator Dembrough is speaking exactly about what I was going to speak about, but I think Representative Gorsuch is the chief sponsor.
Right.
I think Representative Johnson might have signed on. We're looking for more people to sign on. It would be very valuable in February if contractors and others were willing to come in and testify in favor of it. And I think going back to the perception thing, one thing that we do is offer up tours of our training centers on a regular basis. Senator Boquist a couple of months ago, and I've been working with who's the young man in Senator Terrell's office? the coordinator of the Senate, our caucus coordinator. Matt Friesen. Trying to reach out to you and some others. But anyway, developers, owners, elected officials, and teachers and counselors, we try and get them in all the time to take tours of our training facilities. And I've never had anybody take a tour of any of our union training centers that wasn't, you know, that doesn't come out of construction, that really don't know what we all collectively do here in this room, that at the end of the tour didn't go, wow, I had no idea what you people did in here.
Ms. Wilson?
I just wanted to follow up on a couple things. I took shop class in the 70s, so before I got into apprenticeship, so I didn't want to do home ec, right? So I think it is a good...
I'm right there with you.
Good to have all... No, I'm not a bad cook, but still, I like the shop better. It was more fun, more interesting, and bigger tools. So, yeah, I just wanted to follow up. You know, apprenticeship is paid... in our world, off, it's part of our wages, right? So we put that money into a trust fund. You know, it goes directly back to apprentices, and we do, you know, we bring our apprentices in for twice a year for 2 weeks. We pay them per diem. We pay them mileage. I mean, we try to soften the blows of not having to work. But I'll tell you one thing, you know, talking about college kids or even high school kids, I think some of the young folks in our program are pretty shocked at how closely they're tracked. I mean, we know what they did every hour of every day in their working life, plus when they come to the training center, you know, they're scrutinized constantly. Do they have their PPE on? Are they following the tasks? Are they, you know, what's their grade level? Are they, you know, progressing and stuff like that? So, I mean, we really measure them very closely, which is not what happens in the college world. So I think when they come out of our programs, they definitely know the trade. They've had the math. We've educated them all the way through. So, yeah, and I do know at the state council level, we have had apprenticeship, community college representatives there talking to the apprenticeship group and talking to the council about better ways to interface and to make the two-year degree programs available for, I mean, almost all the trades so that they would come out with a certificate.
Thank you.
At the end.
Mr. Redmond.
A couple of comments. I think we're kind of hitting on a common thread here because, mm-hmm. you know, I too was in shop class mm-hmm. starting in the seventh grade, and I'm in construction now. I also went to college. You know, I'm not knocking that at all, but I'll say, in my experience now with we turn out first-class apprentices in these programs, having done both myself, not so much the apprenticeship program because I'm not actually an electrician myself, but going through both, you know, construction, being a carpenter and everything else, is these programs, from my perspective, they actually turn out a better graduate than a lot of other secondary college education programs do. We have people that perform a lot of different roles in an organization, and a lot of the ones that come in, if they want to be an accountant or a bookkeeper or some of those other things, and they have a degree that says that, that apprentice that turned out as a journeyman through the program is much more equipped to do the job that he's set for than a lot of these other ones. And a lot of the problem that we have with, we want more apprentices in our workforce. It's good for all the stakeholders in this. But I can tell you, you know, our JATC had a youth program. The number one obstacle to get attention of the high school kids to get into that youth program, which then gets them entry into the apprenticeship program, was the high school. They're not interested. We approached many schools, and it's a no thank you. So if we want to really look at this and solve a problem, we have to start earlier because, you know, if they had shop class, some perspectives are different. I get the economics of that. Even if it's not a program the school can put on, the school just needs to not be in the way. Because when an apprenticeship program, such as Area 2 Inside Electrical, has the youth program, the school only needs to be supportive and participate in the curriculum and participate in supporting the student to be available to work, because part of that youth program is they get on-the-job training with our journeymen. You know, they have a lot of work-study programs that they turn the kid loose for the day to go do that, but it's difficult for them to, you know what I'm saying. I can go on and on about that.
Ship we need to turn.
And I think that's where we have to really look for. What is the root? If we're saying we have a problem and we need to mandate getting more apprentice utilization, let's look at what the root of that problem is. Mm-hmm. Because the other component of this is economics drive a successful business mm-hmm. to employ the most apprentices that they can. If I employed very few and my competitor employed very many, I will not be able to competitively win a job against them. So we're driven, our company, we have as many apprentices as we can have for what we do and manage that workforce to be safe and well-trained people. So it's, you know, that's what we really need to look at, is all the way back from the school and understand that if those apprentices are available, right now in our program, we've opened 3 times in the last 12 months to get more people in. So it's not like we have a list of 100 apprentices looking for something to do. Right. So, and I think some of the other comments that you explained earlier about, hey, well, there's the committee. Come and ask if you want to change it.
Right.
So.
What is it for?
There's a process.
But we get the people in, get the schools to help. Industry is not going to be the obstacle. Industry wants those people.
Good. Well, we do have an agenda today, and I'm sorry.
Just at a future meeting, could they take the time? Could you bring a couple apprentices in, and we could see what it's like to be an apprentice?
Fine with me.
My foreman's son got accepted into an electrician apprentice program. He lives in Hood River. He has to drive. He's got a schedule like I do.
Sure.
He has to make the same drive that I do into Portland 4 days a week. After he's done working all day in the apprentice program, has to drive in 4 days a week to take his apprentice classes. And I know what it's like to do that. But at a kid that's 21 years old, when he'd probably rather be somewhere else every evening after working 8 hours a day.
Oh, come on.
He has to go, it's brutal. His to be an apprentice, it's tough. And I'd just like to, if
good.
You guys can
yeah.
arrange.
I'm sure we could. I'm sure we could arrange that.
Talk to him. That's it.
Mr. Mullins.
And probably Salem is a pretty central location for meeting. I know the Fitter's got a training center here. I don't know if it'd be big enough to hold a meeting here. But, you know, we've got a lot of training centers in the Portland area if we'd ever want to consider having one of the meetings in one of those.
Is there interest among the committee members to do that?
Or if you want to go a little south, the IBW has a really nice facility in Tangent.
That's a great location, by the way. That's a great location, by the way. The Corvallis guys are fair of that.
So head south, that's a good...
Temecula's got many programs.
Well, I think this segues nicely into our group discussion regarding the charge of the task force. There was a sheet that says SB 782 at the top, 2013. Mm-hmm. We have just a fairly brief time left to go through this, but I think it would be appropriate to just kind of work through this. Pardon me?
Yeah, just remind us.
Familiarize ourselves with what, why we're here.
Yes.
Would you mind taking the lead on this since I'm relatively new here? And,
right.
Yeah. Thank you.
No, I'd be happy to. And I'll also defer somewhat to John Rakowitz since he's here. Was very instrumental in, as we were moving to the completion of this legislation. You know, Senate Bill 782 was kind of controversial, but it included elements. It was controversial at its beginning, but it included elements that we felt that everybody could buy into. You know, there were some sort of common sentiments about the importance of apprenticeship and an interest in encouraging apprenticeship. And also a sense that we really needed to bring smart people together to talk about. If we're going to look at apprenticeship standards on state projects, what's the best way to do that? So that's what led to all of you smart people being, well, most of you are smart, but and I'm here too, to to work on this. And so, you know, as you remember from the bill, if you looked at it, it includes a lot of sort of verbiage about who gets appointed and duration and all that. But I just separated out here the key sort of task of the task force, the things that, you know, we're hoping that this group can end up giving good advice on. You know, first of all, it starts out with some findings. You know, just looking at it from the legislator's perspective, we believe that apprenticeship is an important component of post-secondary education and workforce development in Oregon. The state of Oregon has a strong interest in encouraging apprenticeship on public construction projects. Many states, including Washington and California, have adopted apprenticeship utilization standards for public construction projects. And Oregon may have an interest in initiating apprenticeship utilization standards for state agency construction projects and eventually for all construction projects that use significant state or other public funds. In other words, you know, kind of going back to what Tom and Carl were saying, you know, that the state has a role to play in this, you know, in the post-secondary training that is the on-the-job training, the hands-on applied learning modality that is apprenticeship. But questions remain, and that, you know, we need to be working on answers to. The economic impact of minimum apprenticeship utilization standards on state agencies and other public entities, that is that, you know, is there a negative trade-off in terms of it, you know, really raising the expense of public projects? And, you know, does that make, you know, is there some sort of threshold where it becomes just too big of a burden? But on the other hand, how best to minimize potential negative economic impacts? The whole issue of the use of incentives and disincentives to encourage compliance with apprenticeship utilization standards. Do we have to have penalties? Do we have to have bonuses or, you know, incentives, financial incentives, if we are going to encourage apprenticeship? That's an open question. The oversight of contractor compliance with apprenticeship utilization standards is an issue that we need to explore. The issue, this too is controversial, whether if we do decide on a whatever percent standard, should it apply to just the general, or should it be sub by sub? That's a question that we need to, you know, try to come to broad consensus around. How to best to create incentives to develop a more diverse workforce. And by the way, just, you know, something that I've been thinking about lately is, you know, we have our standard ways of talking about diversity. Based on conversations we had today, I would encourage us to think about geographical diversity there as well, right? You know, that, I mean, how can we do this in a way that's going to help, you know, the kid out in Ontario or, you know, so that's a key element in diversity as well. And then F sort of connects with this geographical issue. The appropriateness of a single statewide apprenticeship utilization standard instead of a range, or should we be looking at a range of standards based on geography or the type of construction project it is? Are there some that lend themselves more easily to standards? And then, so later in the bill, it kind of lays out what we shall do, evaluate and make recommendations concerning apprenticeship utilization standards for state contracting agencies, in the course of which the task force shall consider the economic impact on the contractors, the fiscal impact on state contracting agencies, and potential strategies. So you can see this is just picking up on the questions that are earlier. Incentives and disincentives, lowering over a period of time the contract price at which the apprenticeship utilization standard would apply to a public contract. That was another thing that came up over the debate over this, you know. Should this just apply to very large projects? What do we do with really small projects? And so, you know, is there some sort of schedule that we should be considering? You know, should that be lowered over time as we become more comfortable with standards and, you know, over time perhaps we could lower that amount? Looking at it from the other perspective, we come up with a standard, perhaps over time increasing that standard. You know, if we were to start, say, at 10%, you know, over time, could that become 15%, 20%, or, you know, that's another thing to look at. Strategies for creating more diversity within the apprenticeship workforce, methods for monitoring compliance with the standard, identifying projects that may be exempted from the standard, and the circumstances in which the project may be exempted, which could include the location or nature of the project. Finally, whether and how the apprenticeship utilization standard may be extended to other public agencies. We heard that Washington started with their state agencies and eventually extended it to locals. Is that something we would want to consider, and is that something to put into the legislation or to leave for future legislation, you know, as it's extended? Those are all things for us to talk about. You know, I think we've spent the last couple of meetings just sort of broad background to all of this, but I mean, my sense is that we're at the point now where we can start, you know, getting into the nitty-gritty of answering some of these questions.
And Senator Dember, I'll defer to you if you already have thoughts about this. Scheduling another meeting, what we want to accomplish at that meeting. Do we want to incorporate the conversation about moving this meeting somewhere where we could have some interaction with apprentices or apprenticeship programs? What do you think?
Can I just say one thing, Sandy? Thanks. You know, I think that so our last couple of meetings, including this one, have been connected to when the legislature is meeting during its interim days, you know, which is very convenient for those of us who are legislators. But, you know, the downside of that is we only do this, you know, four times a year, these interim meetings.
And 2 hours at a time.
Yeah. And, you know, my sense is that if we're going to meet our goals, we're going to have to meet more frequently.
That's right.
We don't all have to be at every meeting, certainly, and, you know, including us legislators. But, you know, I think it's probably important for us to be meeting on a monthly basis if you all are up for that. And I don't know about the logistics of that from your perspective.
Oh, the logistics are easy. Your staff is ready to help on a monthly basis. It really comes down to that. That is a question that goes up to the leadership offices where legislators are concerned because there's per diems involved and things like that. We can certainly look into it. It does work better when you have a monthly model like we did with CMGC.
I think more regular meetings would help the process to
flow,
gather some inertia, if you will.
Yeah.
So we can kind of see a progression of ideas and thoughts and building as we go. So I'm not lobbying for more frequent get-togethers, but if we're trying to make something out of this process, it might necessitate it.
And we do have a time frame that we want to make sure that we...
If I may, Madam Chair, logistically, the time frame, if we were to stick with the meeting only during the legislative days, there's only three more sets of legislative days after this one, because we could theoretically meet sometime during the February session while y'all are here. But after that, we only have three more sets of legislative days, and I'm pretty sure the third one is in December, and that's after our requirement to finish it. Mm-hmm. So really, we only have two more legislative days to meet before a deadline of sorts. And so monthly would definitely, I think, make a case of monthly is necessary.
Well, I just wanted to add on and take advantage of Senator Dembrough's referencing. This is the most productive conversation I've heard on this issue since 2009.
We go into the building and we fight. We all agree that this is a huge, everybody here has passion around this. Everybody agrees it's good for the state, good for the industry, good for the trades. So I would encourage the monthly, whatever it takes. And I would also point out, this is the only time I've heard any conversation about the systems you need and all the issues behind it to actually meet a requirement. So I would strongly encourage that this continue as much as you need to, often enough outside the building, so you don't just end up in the pitched battle that people like I and me and some others in this room do on a regular basis.
Mr. Girding.
Again, agreeing wholeheartedly on that piece. And one of the things, if I just look back, being a newbie in this process, you know, the CMGC was the other one, and many of us were on that as well, that if I could suggest our next meeting, we try to break this down into now the bite-sized task that we're going to take on, and I'll just use the example in the CMGC is we early identified three buckets. You know, the exemption process, ultimately the contractor award, and then the execution of it. And it brought it into components of then, I think, helped us make a roadmap to go forward. And from now, right here, there's so many different things. I think the next one, as we get it in place, will probably really help us see the roadmap. That's probably going to say monthly meetings or certainly that frequency. So if I could suggest for the next one that we endeavor to tackle that piece and come out of it with
maybe
that.
Maybe Senator Dembrough and I could sit down and take a stab at putting kind of a time frame together for the things that we might want to address. If you would indulge us, I'd be happy to work with you on that, Senator Dembrough. Okay.
Would you all like to solicit input if they have?
Sure, and if you have comments, please get them to Patrick and we'll incorporate those. Senator?
I'd like to, I'm open to move the meetings around to, we can have one at John's training place, that way he can't tell everybody I've never been to his training facility.
There you go.
He's got a great building. We can move it around to the Carpenter's place.
I could host one in Coos Bay.
There you go.
Yeah. I'm open to that.
We'd be glad to host.
Great. We actually have a pipe fitters training center in Coos Bay, and we're just hoping that a project comes in so we can start filling.
There you go. It's a big day, sir.
Can we save the afternoon for a golf at Bandon Dunes?
Why not? Yes, sir.
I was just going to suggest that I think meeting here next month during session makes a lot of sense because a lot of us in this room will be here anyways.
Okay.
And then either between now and then or at that meeting, it'd be nice to get the rest of the meetings for the year on the calendar.
Whether it's second
Tuesday or fourth Thursday or
first,
whatever
first step,
it is.
First step is ensure that we actually can get approval to do it. Yeah. I think we all think we need to. We just need to convince leadership of that. And it shouldn't be too hard. The second step then is to build that calendar of meetings. Mm-hmm. And then if we meet here in this building in February and build a roadmap for what and where to fill in those meetings, then we could select locations and stuff like that. Because once we're not tied to meeting during legislative days, I don't think we're tied to meeting in this building either.
So, sounds good. Yes, sir.
This will be my last comment. I'll be quiet then. One of the things that, again, on my end, that came out of the previous task force on the CMGC and another, anyway, lessons learned. One was just the value of all the parties as much as possible being at the table as they're discussed, because when it comes to the end and we put something that we're all agreeing to have sat there and heard the other side and said, okay, yeah, I get it, as opposed to moving at a pace that maybe doesn't allow everybody to be in there. I saw that problematic, and also I saw committees. I would be a huge proponent of saying no subcommittees, that we take everything on here, because you go there, it just breaks it apart.
Well, with the knowledge that sometimes if we go to a monthly schedule, not everybody's going to be there.
I understand
that. They can self-select to be there if they can make it. Is that kind of a thing?
Or they can, phone in, exactly. Sure. Something to hear the given pieces.
There was a mention that we might like to get some apprentice testimonies. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. We come to one of the other locations and look that in then, maybe.
Absolutely.
Yeah, a lot of them have apprentices in during the day.
Yeah. Right. Okay. We'll work that in.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. We can all do right. A double time deal, sure.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all. Oh, yes, sir.
I'm interested in hearing from more industry and or trained people, too, about real-life experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's chronicle it over the past 10 years. How has it worked for you in the past? What impact did the recession have on your numbers, perhaps, and your viability? And going forward, what are the challenges? What needs to be, what do we need to address to improve your situation? So.
I think we can figure out a way to accommodate that, most definitely. And if we want to have every meeting start out with that, we could do it for a couple of meetings. We'll see how it goes, but we will incorporate that.
I was just going to say I would agree with you, and you know, I think going beyond that is not only the apprenticeship piece but also the retention piece on the other end.
Yeah,
because we're doing the training, but then we lose them, right. You know, and right. That's not where we need to be.
Anything for the good of the order?
If we get any apprentices here, maybe we can have them check out the refrigerator on the fourth floor.
They'd have to be with the journeyman, though.
Yeah, just saying.
On that note, we are adjourned.
My neighbor. I'll bring